Sagara.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. We will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program. Last week we ended with a quote by His Holiness the Dalai Lama explaining why the ultimate nature of everything tends towards goodness, not evil. He opened the quote with this: "From our own ordinary life experience, we know that there are types of thoughts which can be classified as valid, and then there are others which are invalid. For example, if one's particular thought corresponds to reality, then one can call that a valid thought or valid experience. On the other hand, we also experience thoughts and emotions that are completely contrary to the way things are." Then His Holiness went on to explain that spiritual liberation is based on valid thoughts, while ignorance and its sufferings are the result of invalid thoughts. As we start the program today, I'd just like to clarify what we mean by valid thoughts and why they are regarded as valid, while other thoughts are invalid. Basically, valid thoughts are those that accord with the way things actually exist, as His Holiness said, while invalid thoughts originate from our conditioning, opinions, culture, and anything else that doesn't take into account the underlying nature of how things truly exist. The Buddha said that all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. This means just about everything, because more than 99.9% of what we experience through our senses is conditioned. In other words, it depends for its existence on conditions. It is not autonomous and independent. Now, if something is impermanent, it necessarily cannot have a fixed essence or nature, by definition. It cannot be impermanent and permanent at the same time. Therefore, we can say that anything that is impermanent is also selfless, which basically means it doesn't have a fixed way of existing. When we, for instance, get angry with someone else, we lose sight of the fact that the other person and ourselves are merely a collection of ever-changing conditions and parts, as is the situation we find ourselves in. We have no idea of everything that went on into making the situation as it is, or the making of the other person what he is. We only see what is in front of our faces, and that is precious little of what led into the situation or what's occurring. What's more, we judge from a viewpoint that things and people have their own inherent independent existence, and in particular, that people are in control of their own minds. Just a little thought will show us how wrong this viewpoint is. When you look at a person before you, do you see just a collection of psychophysical bits and pieces that are changing all the time? Or does it appear that the person is real and has an existence not depending on conditions and parts? In simpler terms, do you see the person as a collection of hair, skin, flesh, blood, heart, lungs, brain, arms, legs, thoughts, emotions, opinions, sensations, and so on, all changing from instant to instant? Do you see that all the physical stuff, that hair, skin, flesh, blood, hearts, lungs, etc., is just a collection of cells? Do you see how each cell is a collection of atoms, which are themselves just a collection of subatomic particles and so on? Of course, we don't see people like this. We see them as if they are unitary and independent entities operating willfully in a world full of independent entities. This is the difference between valid and invalid thought. Valid thought is based on seeing how an object or person is really just a collection of other things, parts if you like, and the conditions that allow those parts to come together. There is nothing other than this collection. In terms of a person, there's no little being in the control tower directing things. There's only the psychophysical aggregates moving in accordance with the conditions and conditioning that brought them together. And both aggregates and conditions are impermanent. That is, they are changing instant by instant. The reason you and I get angry when we argue is that we instinctively grasp at both a real me and a real you existing here. Neither of us appears to be just an ever-changing collection of parts, conditions, and conditionings. I grasp at a real you who is frustrating a real me. The anger is therefore based on an invalid thought, a mistaken way of seeing reality. And because of that, it is both invalid itself and weaker than unconditional empathy based on the real view of things as impermanent and selfless. When I see both you and me as selfless and impermanent, I have no reason to get angry. It would be like getting angry at a river flowing over rapids. When we see the real nature of existence, no reason at all exists for emotions like anger, fear, hate, and so on to arise. They're completely redundant. In contrast, all we naturally experience is compassion, empathy, love, tolerance, patience, and so on. That is why His Holiness says that such positive emotions are valid and powerful, and the negative emotions are invalid and basically weak. And that is why Trungpa Rinpoche maintained that reality tends to goodness, not to evil. Of course, by saying the emotions based on invalid thought are weak, I'm not saying that they're not powerfully destructive. In fact, their only function is to bring us unhappiness and misery. They're weak in their mode of being because they are based on mistaken view, not weak in their force when we allow them to take over. They are weak because with the application of right view and antidotes, they can be destroyed, whereas the positive emotions are powerful because their mode of being accords to reality. This reality underpins all things, including people, and we all have what is called Buddha nature, the ability to experientially see things exactly as they are with boundless wisdom, compassion, and love. And that is a potential in all living beings and cannot be destroyed no matter how much negativity beings create. As Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche says, we should understand that our mental and emotional defilement and confusion are not fixed. They are unstable compounded phenomena, are dependent and can be eliminated, like dirt on a mirror. The dirt is not the mirror, and the mirror is always the same, whether it has dirt on it or not. Our mirror is Buddha nature, though our defilements have been clouding it so long they are like second nature. Although all things have a primordial pure nature, we need to think they have to be cleansed of obscurations in the way we clean a mirror of dirt. He goes on to say that the way to move towards seeing this Buddha nature is to generate love and compassion. He compares love and compassion to the flash of a lighthouse to a mariner in a storm. Understanding the basic goodness of ourselves and all beings brings us closer to discovering Buddha nature, which has always been there, though we shouldn't mistake this to mean that Buddha nature is a divine, truly existing soul or essence. That would just be making the same old mistake all over again. I hope this explanation has brought some clarity to what we ended with last week. And now, before we continue with Shantideva's text, let's think about our motivations as we usually do. Let the purpose for this program be the enlightenment not only of ourselves, but all beings caught up in cyclic existence, the endless round of birth and death. That kind of motivation is so great because the object, the infinite number of beings, is so vast and therefore is the best of all motivations. But if you think it is impossible for you, then at least think you are participating today for your own enlightenment. Thank you. Now back to the text that we've been following, Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. We are coming to the end of the chapter on patience, though what we've been learning in this chapter would probably seem like madness to a lot of people. For instance, one of the verses in the last program told us that for the sake of sentient beings, Buddhas will be careless of even their own bodies. And we talked about how, in a life before he became enlightened, the Buddha gave his body to a starving tigress and her 5 hungry cubs. To an ordinary being, that kind of action will probably seem to be off this planet. And in a certain sense it is. You have to be at quite a high level of realization to even consider doing something like that. However, it does demonstrate one or two things ordinary beings like myself can take notice of. For one, even though we may not be able to give our body to another being yet, it is something we can strive for in the future. In fact, it is said in many teachings that is something we have to strive for if we want to reach Buddhahood. Buddhas have no concern for themselves. They're only focused on helping others. But they're not just made that way. To get to such a stage, they train themselves over many lifetimes, slowly, slowly developing their strength of mind until the time is ripe for them to be able to give their bodies. Then also it is taught that in giving their bodies like that, they experience a huge amount of joy and are not fearful at all, which will be quite contrary to how an ordinary person feels. If we have to give even our little finger away, we feel some kind of trepidation or fear. Just think how we react when going to the dentist for a tooth extraction, and that's not actually even giving the tooth to someone else. But somebody who is well-trained doesn't feel that at all when giving their body or its parts. It all comes down to the emotion that drives the whole of our existence, attachment. We are so attached to me and mine that even the slightest threat to our body, our possessions or our friends, makes us start reacting like a baby, either crying or hitting out. Isn't that true? But Buddhas are not concerned at all for themselves or when anything of theirs is threatened. For one thing, they know how to deal with any such situation to minimize the harm, and for another, their concern is only for the well-being of the other beings involved in the situation, so they don't react with a poor me or a fight response. Their response is motivated only by love and compassion. Now, we might also say that a lot of our responses are motivated by love. But if we look carefully, the love we are talking about is quite different from the love of the Buddha. For instance, think of a person that really upsets you. It doesn't have to be someone that you even know. It can be a politician, for instance, whose actions or policies you don't agree with. Now, if you were in control of that person's destiny, what would you do? Would you do whatever you could to see that he or she succeeds? Or would you do something, even a little thing, to needle them, perhaps to make sure they experience some discomfort, or to see that they fail? We ordinary people don't even have to think about it, do we? Kind of automatically, when someone we find difficult to deal with has a problem, we are satisfied or happy in one way or another. But when someone we feel close to experiences suffering, we are apt to get quite upset and worried. And the closer they are to us, the more worried we become. This shows we don't really know what love is. Real love, the type the Buddha experiences, is not like that. It genuinely wants everyone to be happy. It doesn't matter whether people believe in Buddha's teachings or not, or whether they blow Buddha's statues up or not. The Buddha doesn't differentiate between someone who is good to him and someone who is not. For a Buddha, everybody in samsara experiences unhappiness caused by afflictive emotions and karma. So there's no basis for wanting happiness for some and unhappiness for others. Even though some of us may not be suffering a great deal at the moment, each one of us has the potential to go through unlimited suffering in the future. We have the causes in our mind streams, and the Buddha can see that. So he has no need to differentiate between us. As one of the verses in the last program says, "The great compassionate lords consider as their own all the wanderers, of this there is no doubt. Beings then are the Buddha's very self. Thus how can I not treat them with respect?" The Buddhas see each sentient being as a mother sees her only child. But we pick and choose, and the thing we call love we apply to some, while we develop aversion to others or ignore them. Moreover, our love is contingent on how our loved ones treat us. If they do what we want and are nice to us, we are generally happy to continue loving them. But if they do something that doesn't please us or upsets us, we develop some antagonism towards them, which in the end can turn into hatred. And that just shows we didn't have real love for them in the first place. Or even if we did, it was very mixed up with attachment. What is the difference between real love and love mixed with attachment? The one is not concerned with oneself at all, while the other expects something in return. It's a kind of business deal. I will give you love, try to make you happy, but you must also satisfy me. That is samsaric love, and most often leads to problems and difficulties. Of course, when we talk about real love, we don't mean that someone can behave badly and we just let them do it out of a sense that it makes them happy. Say, for instance, I find myself in an abusive relationship. Love doesn't mean I should stay in that relationship out of a sense of loyalty or love for the other person. That is not intelligent. The point is that the wish for the other to be happy remains even while I do what I can to resolve or free myself from the relationship. Anyway, what Shantideva pointed out to us in the final few verses of last week's program is that Buddhas regard sentient beings with genuine love and compassion. And so, if we want to please the Buddhas and continue to make progress on the path to enlightenment, we should do whatever we can to treat other sentient beings with care and respect. He makes the point quite strongly that if we venerate the Buddhas but treat other beings badly, we are being hypocritical, and it's not possible to progress on the path we have chosen. We have to see other beings as even more valuable than the Buddhas, because it is through them that we can directly practice the path to enlightenment. Mostly, the Buddha's contribution to our enlightenment is teaching and guiding, but most of us don't have the karma to come into contact with the Buddhas in person. We are always in contact with sentient beings, though, and so we have boundless opportunities to practice what the Buddhas teach us. As sentient beings give us these opportunities, how can we not develop love, compassion, and respect for them? So now, continuing with Shantideva's text, the next verse reads, "Pleasing living beings delights the Tathagatas and perfectly accomplishes my own purpose as well. In addition, it dispels the pain and misery of the universe. Therefore, I should always practice it." The aim of this chapter of the Guide of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is to show us how to counteract anger and develop patience. Why should we do this? Well, in fact, why should we even try to control our anger and develop patience? To answer that question, we have to know the benefits of developing patience, and this verse explains them. First of all, developing patience through respecting others will please the Buddha's hearts, as Shantideva says. Buddhists have taken a commitment to follow the Buddha's path to enlightenment and regard Buddha as their teacher. Of course, the best way to progress in any educational field is to please your teacher, and it is no different with the Buddha. It's not that the Buddha or our teachers need our veneration at all, but pleasing them with our practice is the best way for us to achieve our goal. And so, if we hold sentient beings dearly and treat them with patience and respect, we will both make the Buddhas and our teachers happy and attain our own enlightenment, or, as Shantideva says, perfectly accomplish my own purpose as well. Also implied in this statement is that not only will I gain enlightenment by holding others dear, but I will also gain much of the temporary happiness I need. Not getting angry with others, but always being mild and patient, makes others feel safe around me. They trust me, and so they generally don't harm me. And they're ready to help in whatever way they can when I need it. We can see then how our initial patience prevents us from getting into difficult situations so much. Both in the short term and long term, patience helps in promoting our happiness. And the more we practice patience, the more we spread peace wherever we go, and the more we are able to dispel the pain and misery of the universe. That statement too has a double edge. When we are still just practicing, we are able to spread peace. And then when we have attained enlightenment through the results of our practice, we can show others how to gain the ultimate state and so eliminate the world's suffering. These are the benefits of practicing patience and refusing to allow anger to control us. And as we can see, they are pretty important. So in the last line of the verse, Shantideva shows us that recognizing their importance, we have to make a very strong determination to constantly practice patience and respect for other sentient beings. And in this determination, he implies that having made up our minds to do this, we have to be mindful to keep to our decision. Else it will be easy to fall back into previous bad habits that result in uncontrolled anger. So, to encourage mindfulness and vigilance, and to encourage our understanding of the benefits of practicing patience, in the next verses, he uses an example we would do well to take notice of. He says, "For example, should some of the king's men cause harm to many people, far-sighted men would not return the harm, even if they were able to do so. For they see that the king's men are not alone, but are supported by the might of the king. Likewise, I should not underestimate weak beings who cause me a little harm." Shantideva uses the case of those who have the protection and power of a king. These people do not behave kindly, but harm many others. Perhaps they're tax collectors who, instead of just collecting due taxes, make people pay much more, putting the extra into their own pockets. Shantideva says, even though people could take revenge against such swindlers, they won't if they are wise, because of the fear that the king will severely punish anyone who interferes with his offices. In the same way, if we are wise, he says, we should not get angry and harm other sentient beings, as they are in the same position as the tax collectors. Okay, but if other beings are like the tax collectors, who stands for the king in the example? Shantideva tells us in the next verse, "For they are supported by the guardians of hell and by the all-compassionate ones. So behaving like the subjects of that fiery king, I should please all sentient beings." Here we have two kings to worry about, as it were. First, the guardians of the hells. For when we get angry with others, we are creating the causes to experience hellish realms where we will meet torturers who are evidently hundreds of times rougher than any prison officer we can imagine. So we want to avoid them at all costs. And the second king is the Buddhas. But it is not as though the Buddhas are going to punish us if we get angry with others. However, we will not make the Buddhas joyful. And as they are our great masters and teachers, that will not turn out well for us. We will hardly continue making progress on the path to enlightenment if we cannot please our teachers. So, because both the guardians of hell and the Buddhas are the protectors of sentient beings, we need to develop the virtue of patience. Shantideva shows in the next two verses that, in fact, it's much more important to avoid the guardians of hells and to please the Buddhas than it would be to prevent a king becoming upset or even making him happy, no matter if he is Kublai Khan himself. Shantideva says, "Even if such a king were to become angry, could he cause the pain of hell, which is the fruit I would have to experience by displeasing sentient beings? And even if such a king were to be kind, he could not possibly grant me Buddhahood, which is the fruit I would obtain by pleasing sentient beings. The worst an angry king could do is maybe torture us for a while and then kill us. But the guardians of hell will be our torturers for eons and eons if we harm others. Although we may beg to die, due to our negative karma, it may be impossible, and we will have to experience much worse suffering than the king could inflict on us. And similarly, no matter how much we please a king, he could not give us what the Buddha can. Of course, the king could make our lives very pleasant. He could even give us his whole kingdom with several palaces and undreamt of luxuries. But these, too, are all rewards for a limited time. When we die, we have to leave them all behind and go to another totally different situation. However, if we do what the Buddha advises and take excellent care of other sentient beings, our reward will be something far beyond a mere kingdom. It will be enlightenment, the state of freedom from all suffering and the attainment of omniscience. What unenlightened king could even start to give us that? Pema Chodron says that Shantideva is showing us that it makes no sense to give in to the tug of aggression. As our aggressive mind grows stronger, the world appears increasingly hellish, she writes. Getting miffed at even little grievances strengthens the power of aggression, and the consequence will always be unpleasant. Most of us feel it's okay to indulge in little irritations, lightweight gossiping, or a teensy-weensy bit of slander. But by doing so, Shantideva says, we are reinforcing the negative mind. On the other hand, if we catch the seduction of hostility and petty-mindedness at the subtle stage, it's much easier to nip it in the bud. Pema Chodron points out that the guardians of hell and the compassionate Buddhas are both our allies, and writes that if we're intelligent about the potential consequences of our actions, both pain and pleasure will motivate us to act wisely. Shantideva then continues, why do I not see that my future attainment of Buddhahood, as well as glory, renown, and happiness in this very life, all come from pleasing sentient beings? While in cyclic existence, patience causes beauty, health, and renown. Because of these, I shall live for a very long time and win the extensive pleasures of the universal chakra kings. In the last two verses of this chapter, he summarizes the benefits of practicing patience and so bringing happiness to other sentient beings. He says, just by practicing patience, glory, fame, and happiness will come in this life. Never mind thinking about future lives. Though, of course, if we develop patience strongly enough, it will continue with us into coming lives, and so even bring its benefits in those lives as well. Patience is the cause to obtain a healthy and attractive body. That means if we practice patience in this life and it becomes a strong component of our ongoing experience, in future lives we will have this kind of attractive, healthy appearance. But even in this life, we will appear more attractive to others, and through our powerful patience, our lives will be less stressed. We will be more healthy and live longer and much happier lives than otherwise. I've mentioned before a friend of mine who in his youth was a very good-looking man. He had a natural bent for patience, and his mother complimented him on that virtue. However, at some time, he decided that patience was not getting him anywhere, so he started letting loose his anger. And because he's a big man, when he becomes angry, he's very intimidating and makes everyone around him quite uncomfortable. He gets very red in the face, his eyes bulge and mouth snarls. It's really quite frightening to see. And in his old age, he suffers from a bad heart and other ailments. Of course, a number of factors probably contribute to his health difficulties, but no doubt the giving up of patience has something to do with it. When he's not angry, he can be very charming and delightful to be around, but that is also tempered by the knowledge that he could quite easily become upset and change. Anyway, it's easy to see that people who are patient and considerate of others gather people around them and make friends easily, while those who are often angry and impatient put people off and so lead generally unhappy lives. I'm not claiming by any manner or means to be free of anger, far from it, but I hope that by considering again and again what Shantideva says in this chapter, one day, probably not in this life but in some far-off future existence, I will be able to say I've perfected patience. That is, after all we can really do. And now time is up. Please dedicate any positive energy we've generated today with this program to gaining perfect patience, perfect enlightenment, to benefit all others. Thank you. I hope you'll join us again next week. Until then, goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.